Welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, covering a range of legal topics, including updates from our four practice groups: private client, real estate, business services, and dispute resolution.
Hello, my name's Suzanne Gill, and in this issue of the podcast, we're discussing some of the interesting articles in September's Quarterly in Advance, the magazine from our real estate team. I'm joined today by Ben Dunbar.
Hello, and welcome to our new listeners who've come to us with our new Moonbeaver colleagues.
Ben, you wrote a very timely piece about COVID clauses in new leases.
Yes, that's right. Listeners will probably be aware that so-called COVID clauses have become increasingly common, whereby some landlords have agreed that tenants will benefit from a suspension of rent in the event of further lockdowns. In my article, I consider whether tenants will be able to insist on the inclusion of such a COVID clause in a lease renewal under the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, and why it might be difficult for them to do so in light of recent case law. I discuss a couple of cases of contested lease renewals that have just been determined in the county court. Poundland versus Top Lane, where the tenant argued over the inclusion of such a clause, and W.H. Smith versus Commerce Real, which concerned a dispute over what might be the trigger for such a clause to take effect.
Our second article about the implications of COVID was written by two members of our employment team, Troy Lau and Emily Daly. Obviously, this is particularly relevant for those of our listeners who are employers or partners in their own business, as well as people who are employees in their own right. Troy and Emily consider the question of whether employers can force employees to attend the workplace. I was particularly interested in a couple of cases they discussed here and the way that the employment tribunals considered behaviour and also solutions proposed by employees who were trying to demonstrate that they didn't need to show up at their workplace. One trend which our colleagues are predicting is that lots of employees make formal requests for flexible working so they can carry on enjoying the ability to work from home sometimes and work from the office on other occasions. In the past, people have often been cautious about turning down these requests in case they're discriminating against maternity returners, for example. However, there are a number of factors that a business can take into account, and of course the key point is that it would have no adverse impact on the company's ability to meet customer demand. Even where someone's physical presence is required in the workplace due to the needs of the business. So, for instance, most relevant to our listeners, where a property agent has to show up to property to actually show it to a potential buyer, employers do still need to be careful. The article has a number of useful suggestions about managing a work-life balance and the needs of the business in those circumstances. But of course, not all of the articles are about COVID this time. Ben, your developer clients often ask you to take out title insurance for defects.
Yes, and we thought it would be a good idea to go back to basics on what such insurance does and doesn't do. Our colleague Harriet explains what defective title insurance is and when it could be handy in a transaction. She points out that it is often an efficient and cost-effective way of dealing with a title defect in a manner which can get a buyer, a tenant, or a lender comfortable with the existence of a title defect. Of course, it doesn't actually resolve the title defect itself. She looks at the types of risk which insurance can cover, such as breach of a restrictive covenant or lack of rights which are required for the use of a property, such as rights of way or drainage. She also looks at something which is becoming increasingly common with the current delays in searches being returned by local authorities, and that's so-called missing search insurance. She also looks at what it will not cover, or where insurers may only offer cover for a large premium, and which other factors you need to consider when deciding whether to put in place defective title insurance.
Now for an update on vacant possession in the context of break clauses. I wrote an article about this in the June edition of Quarterly in Advance, and almost as soon as we'd gone to press, the Court of Appeal published its decision changing the law. So this time we've looked a bit more at what vacant possession really means in the context of that case, which is Capital Park Leeds against Global Radio Services. You might remember that the tenant had a lease of an old building, and their break clause required them to provide a vacant possession. They started stripping out and very quickly realised there was no point restoring the building to how it had been when the lease had started, because some of this was so out of date that any new tenant would just rip it out again straight away. They tried to agree to a dilapse settlement with the landlord, but by the time the landlord had suggested costs to them, there wasn't enough time for the tenant to actually do the work itself. And so they just stopped mid-strip out and they handed back a shell to the landlord. The landlord's case was that because the tenant had removed things like ceiling tiles, which formed part of the legal definition of the premises, the tenant hadn't given back the premises and so hadn't complied with the break clause. And at first instance, the court agreed with the landlord, but the Court of Appeal, which is the new one, found in the tenant's favour. What the landlord's argument would mean is that if the premises burned down between the tenant serving the break notice and the expiry of the break notice, the tenant would be unable to hand back the premises and the break would fail. This was obviously unjust because in those circumstances, it would be the landlord who had to repair the premises. What the Court of Appeal said was that the true test of whether the premises was handed back, they needed to be free of things, free of people, free of legal interests. And, well, Global Radio Services had certainly managed that. To my mind, this is just another example of one of the many pitfalls in break clauses and why you really, really do need to read the small print and then get someone else to read it too.
Yes, they really are a trap for the unwary, and the case law is becoming more and more complicated.
Ben, we've got a new planning minister in the form of Michael Gove. Even before he'd had the chance to change the name of his ministry to the Ministry of Levelling Up, planning rights were extended.
Yes, Matthew Mainstone, our planning partner, has written an article about this. It's the recent introduction of Class MA, permitted development rights to change property from use Class E to residential use without the need for planning permission. Listeners may be aware that use Class E covers a wide range of uses, including shops, offices, restaurants, and health centres. This means that a wider range of existing uses could potentially use the permitted development rights to change to residential when compared to the old Class O permitted development right. There are a number of conditions, however, on the application of Class MA that didn't apply to the old Class O rights, and Matthew goes through these. Matthew also discusses the need to check if there is an Article 4 direction by which the local authority might have disapplied permitted development rights, and he discusses several other factors that should be considered.
I was really pleased that Brad Fern in our construction team wrote a piece for us about liquidated damages. Quite often in a building contract, if the building is delivered later than anticipated, the contractor has to pay a certain amount per week to the future owner or to the occupier of it. And this amount is called liquidated damages, and the amount should really be an accurate assessment of the loss that's suffered. So, for example, if a tenant can't move in on time and has to pay rent on its existing premises or some interim third premises for a bit longer, that gives you a good idea of the amount of the liquidated damages in that case. In the case that Brad covers in QIA, there were a number of milestones, but only two were met, and then the contract was ended. The question the court considered was, if the contract had been ended, was there still a contract left which allowed anyone to claim the liquidated damages? Now, you might think this is a bit of a preposterous argument, but when there's a lot of money at stake, people will take any line they can. The good news is, for common sense, the court held that even in circumstances where a contract was terminated because the person supposed to perform it was at fault, the defaulting party could still be liable to liquidated damages. A couple of tips here for the unwary. Think about having a cap on your liability if you're the one who's liable to pay liquidated damages, and make sure your cap is clear whether it includes liability for liquidated damages or not.
The final article this time is from Philip Slegg. He's looked at conservation covenants. What are they? Well, they are the statutory scheme of conservation covenants proposed in the Environment Bill, which would allow landowners to make arrangements for a conservation purpose for the public good. For example, a landowner would be able to agree with a responsible body to do or not to do something on land for a conservation purpose. such as covenant with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds to promote public access onto land for bird watching. Philip considers the current proposals for this new kind of restriction which would bind land.
Yes, quite often clients feel they're custodians of lands for future generations rather than absolute owners of it. The proposals outlined for conservation covenants is really going to interest anyone who feels that way.
Yes, it might be of interest to charities or other public-spirited landowners disposing of land who want to preserve a conservation area or restrict future activities on the land.
Thanks for summarising that, Ben. Hopefully our chat today has prompted people to go to the Wedlake Bell website or to their inbox to find QIA, where these articles can be found in full. Thank you for listening.
You just listened to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. If you liked our episode and want to know more, then check out our website, www.wedlakebell.com. Wedlake Bell. Building relationships is at the heart of everything we do.